ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The treating nurse or practitioner say something like, oh, well, at least it's not 20 years ago because you'd be dead, you know? And well, like, thank you.
This is Andrew.
It really was, like, such a sense of doom.
Andrew is a queer actor, an award-winning poet, playwright, an all-round very smart, wickedly funny person. But 9 years ago, something happened that radically changed his life.
This was, in some ways, somebody else. This was a new me.
It's something he's written about in his latest book of poetry, Paradise, Point of Transmission. Hi, I'm Taku Mbudzi. This is Earshot and a fresh episode in our series, The Other Me. And it's one you're going to want to hear.
Why can't I just be public and open? Like, it's not necessarily on, like, a Tinder profile.
Why would you not put it on a Tinder profile?
People won't match with you.
Shadow Dance is a story about how science, art, and time can heal. And it's produced by Kirsty Melville. And just a warning, there's talk of sex and a reference to suicidal ideation.
My name is Andrew, Andrew Sutherland. I'm 30. I'm a Virgo, which shouldn't matter. my pronouns are he and they. I grew up in Perth or Boorloo, and then when I was 19, I relocated to Singapore to train to be an actor. And upon graduation, I lived in Singapore for a few years, working as an actor and starting to kind of become a writer and a devised theatre maker.
Andrew was getting loads of gigs, was setting up for a life and career in Singapore. And one of his jobs was performing a shadow dance.
And through the rehearsal and the performance, I got very sick. The sickest that I've ever felt.
He went to the doctor and was diagnosed with glandular fever. And that made sense. But then, a few months later...
Every few months, I would have STI screenings. So I was a responsible gay. I shouldn't say that, actually. I don't want to pass any kind of judgments upon anyone. But yeah, so every few months I would go for these screenings. And in the waiting room, I had the strongest sense that I was going to be HIV positive, that this was the time. I just felt this sinking feeling. I did a rapid blood test, which was like a thumb prick, and it effectively shows up before the doctor in real time, and it came up as positive. One of the first things she said to me was that this would have to be reported to the Ministry of Health. It also meant that as a foreigner, I wouldn't be allowed to reside in Singapore, and that she would do another blood test and I would come back in a week for the confirmation. And that word really stuck with me. I clung to that idea that it would be a false positive. And I immediately messaged a woman called Edith Podesta, who had been the head of acting at the university that I'd attended at my drama school. And I had idolised her. I felt very close to her. And Robertson Quay, where the doctor's office was, is maybe a 30-minute walk. And it's so beautiful. And I kind of remember, like, walking and just, like, looking at all these buildings. And a kind of, like, very vague suicidal ideation.
I pictured myself at the top of each tower, a lean, a glance, a wobble. Still, I continued to walk. I looked up, and with the daylight sun, I saw the moon and stars, and slowly, one by one, the stars started to drop from the sky like flies.
A lot of what was going through my mind at the time and what I spoke about with Edith was this real sense of failure, because I felt that I had let down this legacy of queer ancestors or queer elders or whatever, you know, and hadn't learnt anything from them, and I had been careless when I should have known better.
At first, only gaze and IV drug users were being killed by AIDS.
I had all the knowledge. I had all the knowledge to not become positive, and I failed them or whatever. And she was like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. She was like, well, yesterday your life was something else and now your life is this and you're just going to have to live this life. And I was like, well, that's a very powerful thing to say. And I feel like I owe her a great debt. I called my parents back in Perth and told them what had happened. I remember feeling very scared. It must have been incredibly devastating. They were practical and they were supportive. And we made the plan that I would return earlier so that I could immediately see an immunologist in Australia and start treatment. But this was incredibly tied up with the fact that I was residing in a country that I didn't have citizenship in, the fact that the people that I loved were all there. It all meant leaving and loss.
Many countries, including Singapore, don't allow foreigners with certain medical conditions to live there, and this includes HIV. Andrew knew his name would be added to a register, and all the dreams, all the plans, everything he'd imagined his life would be, crumbled.
I had to go back to where I grew up, and I didn't really want to. And yeah, I felt incredibly isolated and incredibly depressed.
Yeah. How did it feel getting on that plane?
This is so stupid, but the last job that I did in Singapore, I was on like a very popular TV show called Mata Mata, which was like a cop show set in the 80s. And I played a real life serial killer. And the day before my like last flight out of Singapore back to Perth, we filmed like my last scenes for that show, and it was also at Changi Airport, and it was like my character getting caught at the airport, like trying to leave. And so it was really, really surreal because I did this TV show of like me getting like caught by the police and so on. And then the next day I actually left, yeah.
So my name's Liz and I'm Andrew's sibling. Obviously I've known him as long as he's been alive. And, oh gosh, it sounds weird when I'm his sibling, but like he's very handsome and he very much like he was a bit of a dorky kid and teenager and was one of those people that absolutely grew into his face and his looks and just one of the best people I know. I remember very vividly that one night after dinner we were walking and Andy disclosed that he had been diagnosed with HIV, and I was a child of the 90s. Like, the messaging that we got in the 90s was so minimal. It was the Grim Reaper on TV, like ads and don't get AIDS. And it was very much the messaging of death still, and that wasn't the reality in 2014, but it was our reality because I guess it was all that we knew. And so I was uninformedly terrified and just collapsed, like I was so devastated.
I was very aware of AIDS histories in like year 10 at Christchurch Grammar's, you know, all boys school, and like being forced to sit through the movie Philadelphia, which is absolutely cringe, right, for this all boys school. And so I had this real conception that it was this collective communal tragedy, but it was also removed and in the past, and it did mean death. So even though I intellectually knew that there had been these massive bounds, like treatment as prevention had just come to the fore around the time I was diagnosed, it still felt very fatal because of all of this cultural baggage. But also every disclosure feeling incredibly emotionally raw. So it felt a little bit apocalyptic each time.
Antarctica. So I wanted to go to Antarctica. I'd take all my medications, find my way on some research vessel, and in the centre of an endless sheet of ice make the tiniest, safest cut. and freeze the HIV in my blood down in that great mass. How I would persist beyond myself. Although I suppose that would only melt too, the way things are going. Of course, I won't do it. I think it's probably a crime. Biohazard. Viral body out of the body down in the ice. And who can afford to go to Antarctica anyway in this climate?
The outpatient clinic at Sir Charles Gairdner, this incredibly surreal place, but the doctor had a real sense of care and practicality. The conversations were very much around reducing the viral load to what is now called undetectable. And I was started on 2 pills a day. And so this had to become part of my daily reality. Something that was definitely within that first appointment, but also within the language that my parents used, was it's not the end of the world and it's not like it was and oh well, you know, at least it's not 20 years ago because you'd be dead, you know, and even to the point of being like, you know, you wouldn't be here and well, like, thank you, but you don't always need to be reminded that there but for the grace of God go you. And I wanted to say like, yeah, of course it's not fatal, but in some ways it is the end of a world. I wanted to remain in Singapore. And also around that time, I was offered a scholarship to study a master's in China, which again, you know, like had to be rescinded because they have the same laws in China.
But while doors were closing for Andrew, unexpected ones were opening for his sibling Liz.
It ricocheted me into needing to find out what actually was the reality of HIV in 2014 and I'd changed my whole career path because of Andy's disclosure to me and knee-jerk reaction into the HIV sector. I got an amazing opportunity through Positive Life New South Wales and worked for PosLife for 6 or 7 years. As hard as it was, I think I wouldn't be the person that I am today and have the career that I have if not for that moment.
While Liz was busily diving into the world of HIV/AIDS, Andrew was not. He'd told his immediate family and very close friends, but he was struggling to make sense of how to live, how to date, who to tell.
I'm going to ask you something really personal here.
Yeah, I know. So I've gone really rogue as well.
Rogue's good.
Yeah.
So after you'd started treatment, how did you then negotiate having sex the first time?
It was emotional and it was terrifying and it was not good. And I had started dating someone and I feel, you know, in hindsight, I feel so terrible for him because he was having to deal with me and this. But I think he described the first time we had sex as like approaching like a nervous colt, you know, like the, what's a baby horse? I don't know.
Colt.
There you go. Approaching a nervous colt. Was it just that real sense of like fragility? And I think I found it very difficult, particularly early on, to really comfortably have sex, I guess, intimately or even like sober. And in a more casual kind of setting, the question around disclosure is always so fraught and it remains quite fraught.
You face a lot of rejection, stigma, and the threat of violence, even from within the gay community. And rejection is kind of okay, but there are really tricky things around it.
Legally, in Australia, you do not need to disclose your status to a sexual partner, as long as you take precautions to prevent transmission. And that may be by using condoms, by making sure your partner is using pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, or if your viral load is undetectable, like Andrew's. The language these days is U equals U, undetectable equals untransmissible.
I think about the person that I was in my early 20s or in my late teens, and I probably would not have had sex with someone who was HIV positive, you know, and that's on me.
Probably like a year after I had moved back, I started seeing somebody, and it was a very tricky relationship for many reasons. There was a lot of emotional unavailability and difficulty and so on.
And I never disclosed my status. Through the whole time we saw each other, which was probably almost a year, I did not disclose my status to him because I was very afraid that he would not be interested in me and he would reject me. And I thought that he was something of a jock,
like a hunk-ish kind of personality, you know, like really hot.
How much, during that year that you were seeing him, how did it feel to be carrying that knowledge and not disclosing?
I think it felt like a lot of compartmentalization.
Did you feel guilty?
Yes. No. That's an interesting question. I am not convinced that I felt guilty. Shame, maybe more than guilt. And it got to a point where he wasn't going to try to stay in Australia any longer. He hated it here. And he asked me to marry him. So he kind of asked me to follow him to his home country, and I knew that I couldn't because this particular place also had migratory restriction laws for people living with HIV. But then the last night that I saw him, I finally disclosed to him and I was like, well, I can't ever follow you because I'm HIV positive.
And he said that he was also HIV positive.
And I felt this incredible gut punch of like, how did we go for so long? And I felt that I loved him so much, but we were both hiding the exact same thing from each other.
Like all that wasted time.
He told me the story of how he became positive, which was his first partner had lied to him about it and effectively given it to him. And then left, basically. But he used that and was like, you probably got it because you slept around a lot, but I didn't deserve it. I mean, like, the word deserve, right? You know. It has really, like, impacted the way that I think about disclosure and intimacy and vulnerability and how you have to operate in the world.
How has it changed it?
I'm much, much, much more willing to be rejected up front.
Having said that, while Andrew was a bit more open about disclosing to an intimate partner, he still wasn't publicly open about his positive status, and he certainly wasn't out professionally.
It seemed to me like there was this weight of two different lives and versions of self that Andrew was grappling with, in that they'd have this one persona that they felt like they had to uphold and try to maintain. And that's so tiring. That's exhausting, trying to be someone that is you but isn't fully you. You know, if you're keeping this big secret, who have I told and who haven't I told? And it's a lot. But I think because I was surrounded by it day in, day out, and I was exposed to so many amazing people who were openly and proudly living with HIV, I struggled to understand the time that it takes to get there, and Andrew's time in particular, to disclose and to make certain choices about engaging with community and with peers, because the evidence shows that engaging with people that have been through similar sorts of life-altering situations, it drastically improves your well-being and your mental health. And I think I really struggled knowing that Andrew was not engaging, but obviously it's not my place. I wasn't experiencing it. So I probably alienated Andy quite a bit. You know, I was sort of trying to fix things and make things better.
all of the work that I had been writing over the last few years was like so about this, because how could it not be? Because it's this like integral part of my life, without saying it.
The more that I have lived it and thought about it and embodied it, the more that I had to fold that sense that it was something that wasn't me into, no, this is a really fundamental part of who I am and how I can view the world. It's kind of the collapsing of this idea that there is another me into just oneself, into just me.
I was reading about some human trials for a functional cure. It's a cut at the cellular level and then it's neutralized. The virus is effectively gone. I know it's monumental, but I felt, for a second, this selfish kind of unease, which is maybe hard to explain if you're not Poz, or, I don't know, if you're not me. But I was afraid, for a second, that I wouldn't know myself. For the tiniest, safest moment, I felt a kind of melting at the thought of a cure, that I wouldn't ever recognize myself again.
It was like something snapped.
Why can't I just be public and open?
And then something changed for all of us. A life-changing, world-changing event.
When COVID hit,
I was like thinking about, oh fuck, there's this like massive pandemic on, and actually like the echoes of this are wild. But now we know.
I had just been speaking to my employer before we didn't see each other for a long time, and he is a gay man of an older generation, and we were in the car park of this school and he just turned to me and he said, I am so scared and I can't stop thinking about the late 80s and the AIDS crisis and all of that fear and all of that loss, and it's just coming back to me constantly. And similarly, around this time, I really started to engage more intergenerationally with other positive people. Something massive that really came up a lot is that there was so much bitterness at the severity and strength of global and government responses to COVID. And this never happened with the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Also, very much within the early days of COVID and contact tracing, you'd have this demonization of the casual worker, and those things are really reminiscent of that kind of othering and demonization of the kind of person who could get a disease or an illness, which has always been the experience of HIV positive people. It's always been about what did you do to get it. COVID as well, in terms of the way that the public was educated about transmission, about risk, and about community protection and safeguarding, really did provide a framework and a space for me to be able to feel more secure and comfortable being public about my HIV positive status. And people would have a greater scope of empathy or a greater scope of understanding. It was like something just released. And I thought everything that I had been so afraid of in terms of what people knew about me or what people might say about me or this idea of rejection, it kind of melted away.
So I kind of like had a moment of like a kind of public coming out as a creative practitioner. Yeah.
And what did that look like?
It looked like, you know, okay, this is a very cynical thing to say. It looked like an update in my bio. Sexual or dating kind of way, it's still something that I would need to individually disclose. Like, it's not necessarily on like a Tinder profile. On Grindr, which is, Grindr is like the Tinder, but that's way more like have sex right now. And you have the ability to advertise your status, like negative, negative, on prep, positive, undetectable, positive. There's a terminology on Grindr, which is really distressing, which is people asking if you're clean. And clean means, you know, you don't have HIV or like other STIs as well. Yeah, this real kind of binary opposition of like clean and dirty, which is quite stigmatizing.
Sometimes it occurs to me that somewhere between seroconversion and diagnosis, I inherited perhaps dozens of bloodlines, dozens of lives.
Something I'm really fascinated by is this idea of like an alternate lineage or an alternate ancestry. It's an unbroken chain of transmission that connects you back to someone, right?
The perfect viral memory tunneling forward through time, Rood 81 to present day. And maybe each one of them was as frightened and alone as I was.
Like there was someone who had HIV, and then someone else, and then someone else, and then someone else, and then someone else, and then me. So in a certain way, like the cellular makeup of all those people travels down that chain. That might be more of a poetic idea than a literal scientific idea, but I think it makes sense.
I think that it has made the path of his career so much more liberated and free, and there's so much that Andy is going to contribute to the world creatively and personally. I don't think that could have happened in the same way if this had never happened and if he hadn't gotten to this point now of open disclosure. That means that Andy can move through the world fully embracing who they are.
I think one of the most difficult things that probably took me 2 or 3 years to get over was going to bed wishing that I could be cured. And then I think at a certain point I really felt a shift, and that shift was to do with living a bit more openly with people, which is like there are some equally beautiful lessons in it about this idea of recovery and recovery being something that is actually unfeasible and impossible, but also that I don't think that I wouldn't necessarily give it up, you know what I mean? Maybe the perspectives that I have now and the knowledges that I have now and the way that I can like have an intimacy with my body is something that I really, really value.
I will be something other than resilient. A new and careful virality. How peaceful to forget the word recover. No, I cannot absolve you of your risk, but I can pass by you. Gentle. Lick your sweat. And remember there is ocean kept between us. Add me to your list. Please, it will all be worth it.
Shadow Dance was produced by Kirsty Melville. The sound engineer was David LeMay. The poetry you heard was all written by Andrew Sutherland, and his book, Paradise, Point of Transmission, is published by Fremantle Press. I'm Takum Budzi. Join me next time on Earshot to meet two radically different people who struck up an unexpected friendship on the chilly streets of Canberra. See you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.